welcome Pat Hopkins from Indiana University to be the academic discussant for this paper.
So thank you for this opportunity. I am pleased to be here to help interpret this paper. And so the way I view my job in this discussion is it's not like a typical academic conference where I'm trying to sort of talk to academics and just say, okay, here's what you should be thinking about. In this case, I think what I need to do is be a vessel through which our standard setters might be able to better interpret the inferences that they can draw from this in a meaningful way. Okay, so that's the way I'm going to approach this discussion. So the first thing that I want to point out is that the manuscript has the word standard precision in the title, but what it does is it flips pretty freely between standards precision and principles versus rules. And I don't know that that's very helpful to do that, because generally the way that one would think about principles is what does it mean to be principled? And then one way you can think about principled counting standards is that they conform with the conceptual framework. Right? I think that would be the highest ordered principle. And I can recall a financial reporting issues conference that I went to a number of years ago. We were talking about a thorny issue and basically made the observation, well, really all we should need is the conceptual framework. And then, you know, everything else is application guidance at that point, right? And so if we were to think about being principled, well, an example might be in USGAAP, ASC 805 or SFAS 141R, which requires recognition of assets and liabilities that meet the elements definitions in the conceptual framework. That's the standard, right? It basically says go to the concept statement and recognize the assets and liabilities that conform with these definitions that we've taken some time to develop and have argued about a lot over the years, but these are the definitions, right? And it even says non-controlling interest should be measured at fair value because it provides the most relevant information to financial statements users, right? That's in the basis of conclusions. Now, one could then look to IFRS 3, which basically allows a transaction-by-transaction choice as to whether to measure that non-controlling interest at fair value or the proportionate amount of the subsidiary's pre-transaction book value. No one will say that increases comparability. Okay. So then what you might say is, why didn't we make this choice? Well, it was because of book getting, right? It was because getting the standard passed would not have been possible at that time. It was really important to have a mostly converged standard at that time. And so what one might say is that the IFRS in this particular case would be less principled because it deviates from what one might think is the better information set. Okay? It was pragmatic, but pragmatism does not necessarily conform with principles. And so one could think about principles and rules, closeness to the conceptual framework, distance from the conceptual framework, is being orthogonal to precision of the language that is being used within that. Okay, so I would characterize these things as being independent. And I would caution certainly scholars when they start to think about principles and rules as to what do you exactly mean. And I don't know that it's helpful to mix them. So what I would do is I would strip principles and rules completely out of this paper and just talk about standard precision, if that's what you wish to do. The second thing is the setting in this, right? And as Eric pointed out, these are all of the published experiments in the last 10 years dealing with principles versus rules or standards precision. I highlighted in red the two that did not do leases, and in particular the 75% test, right? So what we have done over and over again in this area is we have beat to death the 75% threshold consideration and haven't really gone down and explored what is it about this language that is doing this to all of these subjects over and over and over again. And Libby Rennekamp and Sievert basically say, you know, we haven't really thought about the key elements of, they say principles versus rules, they're clearly thinking about standard precision, that's causing this behavior. And so let's dive into that thing, whatever that thing is, and let's understand it better. But what we've done is we sort of use that same apparatus over and over again. Oh, you don't need to write this down. This will be available in the gift shop after today. I'm happy to send these slides to anybody who wants them. Okay, so and I will certainly care to share them with you. Okay, so this is just set up because I'll talk a little bit more about the leasing context in just a little bit. Now, theory and text. So this paper borrows heavily from the Agogli et al. 2011. Okay, and in their theory, they're pretty specific about regulator second guessing and also economic substances and how this is going to lay out and how these things interact. It was less clear to me how this particular setting changed that much from that. And so I'd like to have seen a bit more as to what does that mechanism look like. And economic substance was completely missing, really, from the theoretical discussion, but then it's included as an ad hoc factor in mediation analysis later on, without a whole lot of explanation as to how they relate. And they probably have got a very specific path where these things load into each other. And so I would have liked to have seen that. And so, you know, for an example, if you look at the Agoglia et al. Averages for the post-experimental question on regulator second-guessing, what you get is, you know, 6.64 for the less precise condition and 2.14 the more precise, but yet it appears that they're identical, virtually identical, in the present study for that same condition. So there are differences here, and I would like to know more about why that is. And in psychology, there's this thing called the reproducibility project, where what they did was they took 100 studies and they said, okay, how many of these things replicate? And it's an appallingly low number, right? And so what you would want to do is think about how robust, first of all, is the Agoglia finding, but then also overlay, okay, what are we finding here? Is it an artifact? And could it be that some of these folks, because we have such disparate experience sets among these people, I think the subject base we're drawing from here is slightly different from them too. And so I just wanted to know a little bit more about the differences to this. Now, the design and inferences that we have, okay? So these first two bullet points were missing from the research, I think it was the research design or the research design slide that Carol pointed out. But footnote 9 says that the instrument required each subject to projectively evaluate their future self and overlay that on their current self, and they manipulated whether that was more permanent or less permanent, okay? No results there, okay, so there were no differences there. But one thing we do know is that every subject was asked to evaluate their future self. That's a very projective, future-oriented activity, and so now what one wonders is sensitivity to horizon, incentive horizon, then exacerbated by the idea that I'm thinking about myself in 5 years, right? So now does that suddenly cause me to lock in on these incentive horizon features? So what one might want to know is how fragile is the result, and does it require one to go through this particular first task to do that? The second one, as noted in footnote 12, is that all subjects had to make a decision as to whether to curtail R&D investment, okay? And what's interesting is, regardless of the incentive horizon manipulation, they all basically wanted to reduce R&D spending by $1 million. So now, if the incentive horizon is so stinking important, right, to these folks, why in the long horizon would I not just deal with immediate reporting concerns, but actually have a higher chance of hurting my performance in future years in real activities, right? Because this R&D investment is going to actually influence the real performance of this firm in the future. And so this was just a puzzle to me, because this was such an overt club over the head, right, before they even thought about the leasing, that the leasing almost seems like it's second order to this, and I wanted to understand this a lot more, that what was going on here. And then the mediation analysis, you know, didn't really play out as planned. We got it in a subset, one subset, but not the other one. But the one thing that I caution on this is called a measured mediation setting. And so a measured mediation, as opposed to what we call manipulated mediation, measured mediation, the mediating variables are captured or elicited in the same experimental setting, you know, procedure, as the primary dependent variables. So what we know as humans is that we like others to think we're consistent in what we do, right? I don't want for you to think I'm loopy. So what I'm going to do is give you answers that line up, right? So I'm going to make sure. So implicitly, we're getting correlated responses. Right? They're not independent draws. And in order to have statistical validity within these models, you really need to think about are these things really true indicators of how one might perceive the situation, or is it conditional on the answer I just gave you? And that's where you get dependencies built in just through method. And so this is a brand new paper by this large committee of authors, Ace, Gudemos, Cadus, Kuntz, and Libby, based on a panel they did a couple of years ago at the AAA. This is finally coming out in work paper form. It is excellent. It is a state-of-the-art paper on process measures and how you might go about this for truly valid inferences. So I would really suggest that everyone read this who's interested in this. Okay, I've got 5 minutes. I think I only have 5 minutes left here. Okay, so now when you think about the leasing setting, okay, the leasing setting that they use, the present study is using sort of the same apparatus as other studies, which is, yeah, I'm going to give you the old language from US GAAP and IFRS, right? So it's 75% or more versus the major part of. And then I'm going to fix and treat exogenous all other features of that lease. But not only that, as I point out in red here, I'm also going to fix and treat as exogenous and interpret for you thresholds that exist within this lease. Like the monthly rental payment has been set to 92% of the fair rental value. Being told that is a fact. And also that the economic life is 10 years. Okay. So now let's imagine, so we all know that leases and this setting have got all sorts of inputs that can potentially influence these judgments, right? And so let's imagine that I'm a manager with incentives to purposely intervene in the financial reporting process with the intent of obtaining some private gain. Okay, so I'm the nefarious guy. And so when I go to this leasing setting, is the most important thing the 75% test, or tell Siri I'm busy right now. If this is the most important thing that we want to know, what am I going to do? Well, am I actually going to monkey with the estimated economic life? Or am I going to go out and try to find these fair rental values, and I'm going to determine whether those fair rental values could be either 75% or more, or the major part of, but by requiring people to actually go through this as a manager, we know there's a lot of wiggle room in coming up with those inputs. But yet, these are highly precise. We think about precision. It's not just standards precision. I'm busy right now. So it's not just standards precision, but it's input precision too overlaid on that. And what happens if that precision goes away and that we have all sorts of other judgments in place? So that's what I would like to know in this. Would usage of these other things exacerbate, mitigate the findings that we're finding here?
Incentive horizon manipulation.
So in this case, the CEO's hypothetical compensation package included features, and I'm unclear as to what features were most important. The CEO's bonus threshold required $2 million of expense reduction. The analyst's forecast target required $1 million. Prior to lease classification, all subjects reduced by $1 million. And so now, I didn't understand how they were making this judgment conditional on the fact that they had that R&D reduction already. And so what we know about this incentive structure that we had here, that's illustrated up here, is that it's called a quota system. Okay, so in our doctoral, for the academics, we've read Healy 1985. That's a quota system, right, where you have these thresholds to manage earnings up and down. This type of system has been investigated everywhere, right? Federal deadlines for job training program reporting, doctors in New York City, when they hit their mortality cutoffs, they take on less risky surgeries. So we see this over and over again. So we know that accounting systems are complex, and we also know that these earnings management incentives produce multi-period strategies of pushing and pulling. Right? And so this is one where the incentive was so immediate, but given this type of a bonus threshold, we might see the opposite behavior in one where they're trying to hit targets in a different period. Right? So I would want to think about this more clearly from a robust, real incentive where there's competing incentives to manage. And then evaluating the goodness. It's all through the lens of, gosh, you're aggressive by wanting to have higher earnings today. But one asks, what's the right answer? And so what I would have liked to have seen is a control condition without incentives, right? To just say, what is the answer in the absence of this stuff, right? This is a capital or operating lease. And so I wanted to know that as well.
I think I'm in the home stretch. Yes, my last slide.
So the rhetoric in the manuscript, I think, could be fixed a bit to help make it more convincing. The first thing is that it mischaracterizes the convergence activities of the FASB and the ISB. Right? People who are as old as me and older remember the Norwalk Agreement, right, in 2002, the MOU in 2006. We all know that business accommodations is a converged standard that came out in 2008. There's been a lot of convergence activities through the years. So I think we really need to think about that long history of convergence as far from a rhetorical perspective. The other thing, I notice this only because I teach advanced accounting, right? So I know these things very well. The manuscript says that ASC 810 is a rules-based standard because it's got a 51% majority ownership on threshold. What it doesn't say is that this particular standard, ASC 810, requires you to go through this incredible VIE consideration where it's got all of that squishy language about power to direct before you get to the very end and it says, oh, by the way, you can evaluate this as a voting interest entity. So you basically have that same power to direct stuff going on in ASC 810 as you do as IFRS 10. Right? It's a very similar standard from that structural perspective. Typically in these papers, we get a lot of detail as to how many people were contacted, how did the attrition work, you know who was participating, who wasn't. I did download your dissertation and looked at the stats there. The number of analysts didn't agree to that, so there was differences in the numbers and the means. But the table 3 that I got exactly agreed to the means in that. And so I think just making sure that you describe the process of how these folks went away is really important. And again, it's rhetorical. It's about convincing people of your point. And then there's all sorts of manipulation check questions in here. And so typically what you do if you're really theory testing is you say, I want to make sure I'm only dealing with the people who noticed correctly what it is I was up to. I don't want the lazy ones. I want the ones who are actually trying and who are doing this correctly. And so typically what we see is for robustness purposes is you include these type of analysis too to say, okay, but if I limit it to the people really paying attention, here are the results I get. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're different. But I would love to have seen that. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.